at KABU. It's only on your community radio station that you're going to hear a discussion like you just did. So please, if you can, send your support our way by donating to KABU, or better yet, by becoming a sustaining member. You can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 or click on donate in your KABU mobile app. And thanks to everyone who has donated generously in the past to keep community radio alive in Portland. I'm Patricia Colbert, and I've been your host for the hour. Catch us again next Monday morning at 9 a.m. for our special programming to honor Indigenous Peoples Day. Thanks for listening.
Tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
You are listening to KABU Community Radio, and we are in the middle of our fall membership drive. Help us meet our $55,000 goal by making a contribution today. KABU's organic, free-range, and independent programming is only possible with your support. Give now at kboo.fm/give. You can also donate by texting the word KABU to 44321 or by mailing a check to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Our members continue to fertilize community radio every time they give.
Can't get good reception of KABU on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
Hey yo, this is Clipping. You're listening to KBOO.
Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we get started, I want to mention that we are in the midst of KABU's fall membership drive. KABU is commercial-free, volunteer-powered radio made possible by people like you. Not only that, KABU has trained thousands of people how to make radio, all for free, thanks to the support we receive from our members. So help us meet our $55,000 fall membership drive right now. We are community-funded, We're community-funded, so we need your support to get there. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. For years, Portland's been renowned for its vast urban canopy, but in recent years, that canopy is shrinking. As the climate crisis tightens its noose around our communities, trees are one of the most important allies we have to stave off the worst impacts from a heating planet. Today we talk with Michael Meskell, Assistant Conservation Director with Portland Audubon, about the need to protect, not eradicate, our urban canopy. Michael, welcome to Locus Focus.
Hello, Barbara. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on after all these years of hearing about you and occasionally actually getting to see you.
Yeah. It is great to be here, and I'm an avid listener, so I'm glad to be part of it today.
Well, I just heard you speak about trees. Actually, it's getting on to be several months now, how fast the summer slipped by. But you were part of a Rumble on the River panel talking about the importance of trees in our city. And so today we're going to kind of maybe reiterate some of the high points of that talk, which made me think about many years ago, my aunt, who lived in Kentucky, came to visit me in Portland. And she flew into the airport, and I came to pick her up. And she said, "I felt like I was flying into a park." And I think about that every time I watch them cut another tree down in Portland. So what happened? I mean, I know that when my aunt flew into Portland, I don't think you were born yet. And so I'm not sure you can imagine Portland when it looked like a park, particularly the east side, east of 82nd Street, which was basically Douglas fir forest with little houses poking in and out. So what happened?
Yeah, well, a lot of things have happened. And so, today I hope to recount some of those. And I always like, when talking about trees, I always like to start with why trees matter. both to us personally, but also to me professionally as a conservationist working for Portland Audubon. And trees are such an important tool for integrating nature onto the urban landscape. Apart from parks and natural areas, they are the key tool to really connect habitat for insects, for birds, for mammals, to clean our urban air, to reduce temperatures, to expand our biodiversity, and to also make our place just more livable, connecting people to nature, just making our streetscapes more enjoyable. And so I always like to start with my appreciation for trees and all of those ecosystem services that they provide. Our tree canopy in Portland has long been a really key asset to our livability. And over the last 10, 15 years, it has really been hammered by a bunch of different efforts and policies and poor decisions that have led to its reduction. So I always like to dive into data. And my colleague Vivek Chandez at PSU, who's a renowned researcher at PSU, specifically around.
And a frequent guest on Locus
Focus. A frequent guest. And I hope that you bring him back in the coming months, as he's just completed an analysis of the Portland tree canopy, specifically since over the last 7 years, as the more recent and current Portland Tree Code has been in place, and it documents sort of those trends that you've been observing and we've all been observing of the decrease in canopy.
Now, you mentioned the Portland Tree Code. Now, that is supposed to be the reason why Portland has such a great tree canopy. It's because of this tree code, which when it was first established seemed like it was, I'm not sure, the first in the nation, but certainly a far cry from what most cities in the United States, not to mention the world, have.
Yeah. So the Portland Tree Code, or Title 11 is the technical name of it, in its beginnings was going to be the best tree code in the nation. And there were years and years of advocacy and effort by plenty of folks that brought that vision to city council. And the timing that it came to city council was very unfortunate, that overlapped with our most recent recession in that time. And thus those big aspirations ultimately were hampered by the need to find balance with other initiatives. And so the code has lots of great aspects to it. And at the end of the day, it is more of a tree mitigation policy as opposed to a tree preservation policy.
You know, you mentioned the word aspiration. I think last time I was talking with Bob Salinger, he said, I hate that word because aspirations are all wonderful, but they never become reality. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about what happened to those aspirations.
Yeah. So the aspirations were to expand our tree canopy and to do so in an equitable way. It has not reached reality because, as I mentioned, it is a tree mitigation code in which does not truly protect trees, but rather assigns a dollar value to them for developers to remove. So if the market will support that, that's what happens. And so in so many of our, especially with infill development, which in a lot of cases is a pro-environment type of development, in Portland, it has not, in a lot of cases, because we have not protected trees in that equation.
Well, I'm thinking, first of all, I want to talk about the difference between mitigation and preservation. Because mm-hmm. mitigation, when I first heard the word, it sounded to me like it was kind of a weak-kneed, strange, duplicitous way of not doing anything. Just saying you're going to mitigate. Because first you're going to destroy, and then you're going to mitigate for the destruction. Yeah. So let's talk about the difference between mitigation and preservation and why mitigation in some ways is so harmful.
Yeah. And this is really harks back to what the data has borne out over the last 7 years that has shown that our canopy is decreasing over that time, over the implementation of Title 11. And while the city and private entities and nonprofits have put significant effort into further planting out our urban tree canopy, that has not outpaced the decline of and the removal of the tree canopy. And I think there's one key sort of theme to that, is that the trees that are being removed in large part throughout the city are large form mature trees, which are providing significant natural resources and ecosystem services in their older age, where they're sequestering more carbon, creating more shade, filtering more air and water, and also providing a significant habitat for insects, birds, and mammals, and for humans who live amongst them. And the Title 11 ultimately allows for the sacrifice of those large form trees with the replacement of small young trees that will take decades upon decades, sometimes centuries, to provide those same ecosystem services.
Well, sounds like scientists are not involved in some of these decisions, or at least scientists who understand math.
In a lot of ways, yes. And I am also hopeful that the great research that Vivek and others are doing, specifically within Portland, demonstrating this decline, and also at the same time coming forward with policy solutions that can shift the direction of our urban tree canopy. I'm hopeful that science will be integrated into future iterations of the tree code.
We were mentioning market forces, and I feel like there's kind of a connection between the way we've decimated our treescape in Portland and also decimated our architecture, that in many neighborhoods around the city, I mean, definitely in mine, but I've seen it all over town, there's been this replacement of small cottage, often really cool Victorian houses and structures, a lot of them businesses, with these behemoth 4-story, 5, 6, 10-story buildings. Mm-hmm. When they were just little houses that were there, there were trees in the yard, not to mention on the street. And some of those trees are really old. So the market forces not only take out the trees, but they also take out buildings that can actually survive with trees or integrate with trees. And I think that somewhere there's the same kind of greed that's involved. And we've seen this. I think about the development that happened in Portland in the early aughts, where like in Selwood, this beautiful building was designed for the library and there's condos above, and it's a cake style, so the second and third and fourth stories are all recessed from the street. And it really fit beautifully in with the spirit and the architecture of the neighborhood. Now these things are going up that are just big boxes, and they're often black, and they are, I feel, really removed from the community. And that's what market forces do, because these new buildings are all basically from the same template. So they're much cheaper to build, and the developers make a lot more money. Do you think that that's the same kind of thing that's going on with the trees?
Definitely. And it is because we haven't made space for trees in those sort of development initiatives, in which if we did at the forefront, we could have increased density and brought in more spaces for more neighbors, and especially in our urban core, and dedicated spaces to trees. And ultimately, some policies did not do that, and we're learning from that now.
What are those policies?
One of them is the residential infill project, which looked to really facilitate infill density, which is a really important priority, especially as we're trying to be a more climate resilient community and a welcoming community. And at the same time, that policy did not integrate space for trees adequately in that equation. And that is borne out. And I think we have learned from that. I think there have been some improvements in the second iteration of that policy, and some other local communities really learned from that process, specifically the city of Milwaukee, which is where I live. And it's also a space where I participated on a middle housing policy that really incorporated increased tree protections and space into that same equation of welcoming more neighbors and increasing affordability in urban infill development.
Well, I wonder if some of the reasons why Milwaukee had such enlightened policies in this direction was that its then mayor was Mark Gambo, who's now our state rep, which is great.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of difference between what Mark Gambo brought to his office and what we've seen in Portland City Council and in the mayor's office for the last 7 years.
Yeah, we have lacked sort of the environmental prioritization or leadership, especially on the green infrastructure end of the spectrum of the city around trees and natural areas and other significant protections. And that has borne, the lack of that leadership has borne out in policy.
What would you like to see, given the limitations that we have right now? Is there anything we can do without actually changing some of these ordinances and titles and things like that?
Well, there actually are lots of opportunities to change those policies and ordinances, and I think that is where we have the most opportunity. In addition to sort of continuing to build the support and the advocacy for the tree canopy, which so many great nonprofits and broader community groups are doing and have been doing for a long time. And there's some really significant opportunities in the near future for those folks to help inform and shift Title 11, which will be coming up, and that's the Portland Tree Code again, which will be coming up for review in the next 2 years, where they can consider the shift from a mitigation to a preservation-focused policy, with also some removals of some key exemptions that are in place. There's also some other really exciting funding streams that are coming into place.
Well, we'll get into the good news at the end of the show. First of all, we have to sort of plow through all this nasty news.
Yeah.
In the meantime, I want to let you know that you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Satellite stations KPFG up here from KODXL PFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Michael Meskel, who is Assistant Conservation Director with Portland, Oregon, about the need to protect, not eradicate, our urban tree canopy. And I also want to remind you that now is a good time to become a member of KBOO during the second week of KBOO's Fresh Off the Vine Fall Membership Drive. KBOO's programming focuses on local communities, artists, activists, and people like you. Join now and fertilize the airwaves by helping us meet our $55,000 Fall Membership Drive goal. We're community funded, so we need your support to get there. Just go to kbo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321, or you can mail a check to KBOO FM, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. And thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Well, before we get to the good news, I wanted to talk about some of the other challenges. One of them, talking about, first of all, the problem with the street trees is that they're planting small trees that aren't doing much. I think you told me the other day when we were talking that also they didn't water them after they planted a whole bunch.
Yeah. So I kind of, there's going to be a couple examples I'm going to list here, and they're related to agency dysfunction. So we'll start with the Oregon Department of Transportation, which has jurisdiction over street trees on some significant corridors within the city of Portland. Previously 82nd, which just switched over to the city of Portland, which is a great move, but also Outer Powell and McLaughlin and a couple other key highways. And in those spaces, ODOT has long prioritized throughput of single occupancy vehicles. And so maximizing the car lanes has been their top priority and really only priority in a lot of places, which has been at the detriment of the environment, but also community safety in a lot of places. And so in those designs of those really important thoroughfares, there's very little space for trees. And so those those communities have long been urban heat islands and not benefited from
street But actually, when you talk about Outer Powell and also Outer Division, this mm-hmm. is what I was talking about. There were the Douglas fir forest that was there in the 70s and early 80s with little houses.
Yeah.
And those houses have all been replaced for the large part by rather extensive apartment complexes and strip malls and all the things that have really mm-hmm. suburbanized that area. And they cut most of the trees down. So I find it interesting that what was a heat island probably in the 90s and the last 20, 30 years was a forest before that. Mm-hmm. And I kind of want to look at the policies that create that, not just the policies, but also perhaps the capitalistic pressures that do as well.
Yeah. And actually, I'm going to tack back to one of the key findings from Vivek's study that is currently under draft and will be published in the coming months. And it shows that there actually is not a correlation between multifamily developments and or the expansion of those and a reduction in tree canopy. It has been around the footprint size of development. And so this kind of kicks back to some city policies that are allowing or aren't allowing space for trees. And then I'll touch on the Outer Powell project and sort of the Division project, in which historically there was not space allocated to trees. And then as they're rehabbing those streets, they've continued that and expanded the right-of-way in a lot of cases, taking out trees that were in the front yards of many of these houses and thus reduced the canopy.
Actually, I mean, I think they've taken out 500 or so trees, I think, on Outer Division. Mm-hmm. I have a friend who lives, and this is the other side of town, which is has much better tree canopy than East County. Mm-hmm. She lives off on Cornell Road, actually, at the sort of intersection of what used to be rural, very rural countryside and Portland, and now it's all suburban. And she lived far back from Cornell Road back when I first went out there in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And they have been encroaching and encroaching. And the most recent one, they took out all these trees in her front yard. And she's got this tiny front yard. And there's, I guess Cornell is now a four-lane street, where it used to be two lanes. And it's very, very painful to be watching this. And she's been fighting the city. Actually, I think she lives in Washington County. So she's mm-hmm. been fighting Washington County for a while. And she's unincorporated Washington County. But I think that that's an indication. I'm thinking, as you're talking about people losing their trees in the front yards, oh, yes, this happened to my friend Laura. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk a little bit more about that and what it's like to be living in an area where you had all these beautiful trees and all this greenery and all this health around you, and it's just stripped away by the state or by, in some cases, Peabody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a traumatic experience, and it's a traumatic experience for the human residents in those spaces, the folks who use those transportation corridors, but also for wildlife who have sort of been able to coexist in that space with human development for a long time. And yeah, it is not just in Portland where we're losing tree canopy; it's all over the state. And and there is a lack of leadership of prioritizing trees in our built landscape, which really needs to shift, especially as we're trying to build climate resiliency into our landscapes. And I know that a previous guest talked about sort of the governor's efforts to increase housing opportunities at the state legislature in this last session that was pushed back on. And we're really trying to shift her framing, which has pitted the environment versus housing, when in fact they can coexist and should coexist. And the climate crisis and the housing affordability crisis should be joined together in finding solutions.
Yeah, I've just been finishing up my client's new book, Doppelganger, and she's talking about just basically a lot of reasons why people who you would have expected to have been liberals have been sucked down the rabbit hole of Steve Bannon, Tucker Carlson kind mm-hmm. of weird conspiracy right-wingness. And at the end of the book, she's talking about our need to, she calls it unselfing, where we sort of get out of thinking that our victimization is the only thing that's really horrible, and then we'll just victimize everybody else and seeing other people's struggles. But I know for years, like Bob Salinger, your mentor, mm-hmm. has been advocating at the local and regional and state level for housing in connection with protecting nature. And there are other the housing advocates, many who are also advocating for protecting trees. I wonder if that's just still kind of a nascent movement, or if you see that as something that could really grow. Because if Naomi Klein is right, that's what's going to save us.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I am eternally optimistic. In my role, I have to be that way. And I think there is some good momentum in that space of the broader understanding that we need complete healthy communities, and we need more space for human residents that have access to nature and that have trees in their yards that cool their spaces in the summer and create.
Well, we need yards. I mean, that's the other thing that I want to get back to when you talked about what Vivek Chandra was talking about. It's not the multifamily units themselves that are problems. It's their footprint. Mm-hmm. But like, for instance, this little house on 13th Street in Selwood, which was torn down as a four-story apartment complex, which takes over the entire it's half a block. And they put a couple spindly little trees in front of it. But they took out maybe 6-8 trees in the yard. So how do we find a way to incorporate backyards and front yards into what are also multifamily dwellings that hold enough people to deal with the need for, as you say, middle housing, which we should probably define at some point today?
I'll jump on that real quick. Middle housing is duplexes, triplexes, quadplexes, and up to sixplexes that can easily be located within existing communities. And so I think there is a two-pronged effort on ensuring that we have, we retain and continue to grow our urban tree canopy as we infill. And that is ensuring that there is space, whether that's by protecting setbacks for the front and backyards to allow for and mandate trees to be retained as we continue to build within our urban landscape. That coupled with more allocation of the right-of-way on the front end of those developments for the city to lead in making more space for trees to exist and to plant and maintain them and to start thinking about the trade-offs of not allocating so much space to on-street parking, but instead to convert some of that space into large form tree wells that can host a Douglas fir for the next 300 years or an oak that could provide so many other secondary benefits, including pedestrian safety, which there are some really exciting things that PBOT is actually pushing for along that line.
If they get funded.
If they get funded.
As you're talking, I'm remembering this struggle back in the late 80s to save an oak in Corbett. And it was, I think, on the corner of Gibbs and Corbett Avenue. And it was like there was a house, and there may be even been a vacant lot or so. Mm-hmm. And there was this big oak. It was a multi-hundred-year-old oak. And one of the neighbors heard this chainsaw revving up, and he runs out, and he says, "Oh, woman, save this tree." And mm-hmm. actually it started a movement, and people sat in and protected the tree and wrapped the tree to keep the from being cut down. And finally, the developer was going to, back in those days, they were building these townhouses that were like fourplexes, but they'd go in and they'd bulldoze down to street level because a lot of these were on hills, just bulldoze, take all the vegetation out, and then they would put in the driveway and the houses. But this movement actually got this particular development to save the corner of the yard where the oak was. That oak is still standing. Awesome. But I'm wondering, what's the difference between back in 1988 and now in terms of getting people to appreciate that you need to save the oaks?
Yeah, I think that same sort of energy is out there. And those individual fights are really important for building both community support and understanding of those specific fights. And the sort of the basics of protecting those trees need to be in policy that sort of force development to consider keeping that tree within their site plan and having it be a significant resource to them and an asset to them in that future development if they can have some flexibility to design around it. And so that's really where Portland Audubon, we help fight those individual fights, but we also really try to help inform the long-term policy solutions that can ensure that those fights don't have to happen in the future, but rather are baked into policy and future development plans.
Well, you mentioned that there's this tree code is being revisited.
Mm-hmm.
So what's happening right now, and how do you see that this tree code could actually protect trees as opposed to just mitigating trees?
Yeah. So it's a three-pronged process that the Urban Forestry, which is a portion of Portland Parks, who's leading this effort. The first was to propose some technical, very minor changes to the code, just to allow for its simpler implementation, which was a couple years ago. They're now in the process, the second stage of the process, of coming up with a new forest management plan, which is really important to sort of set goals and some key vision and policies that it hopes to bring out in the third stage, which is like the more substantive amendments to Title 11.
So what would that entail?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple key areas where Portland Audubon and other advocates hope to push for. So there is the argument over mitigation versus preservation. So it's pushing the policy to make space for the actual requirement of preserving especially large form trees, but also other significant trees, whether it's specific species or age or location, because of the services they provide. So it's actually shifting the policy to ensure that they cannot be removed at any cost. There are some significant exemptions that are in place in Title 11 right now, one of which is industrial lands are exempt to most tree protections, which is a huge factor in our urban heat island distribution across the city. Along Columbia Corridor in North Portland, it is some of the hottest urban heat islands that has been demonstrated through tons of studies, many of them by Vivek, that have really demonstrated how that policy decision bears out on the landscape. And so that exemption is a really important one that is going to be a top priority for us to shift.
Now, as I've talked with Bob Salinger many times about this particular exemption, which he's been fighting for since birds were dinosaurs, as he would say, but because the Portland Business Alliance and the whole industrial community down in the Portland Harbor and the CEI Hub is so powerful, and obviously they've really been showing their muscle in the last 2 years,
mm-hmm.
getting rid of Joanne Hardesty, replacing her with Renee Gonzalez, and having a city council that just bends at their will. The tree exemption for industrial lands going to be overturned, do you think, with all the forces that have been, who got it in place to begin with?
Yeah. Again, I'm leaning into my optimism. I think that, the tide is turning on understanding the importance of trees, especially to make our communities more climate resilient. The heat dome of a couple years ago and our continued really hot summers that we're having, I think are making it clearer and clearer to the broader community that trees are such an important cooling tool, in addition to all the other benefits they bring. And so I think there's some good momentum on overall just community understanding. There's also some good work and shifting that's happening within the city to understand the importance. And I think when we think about trees on industrial lands, the benefits are both there to the environment that's around them, it's to the communities that live near them, and it's to the workforce that is in those spaces. And so we think it is something that the Portland Business Alliance or the Metro Chamber, whatever name they've come up with.
Keep calling them Portland now, Business Alliance.
or other industrial advocates will hopefully consider sort of the livability of their workforce and hopefully not fighting against this shift.
Well, unless they're all planning to go to Mars with Elon Musk, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Micah Meskel, who's Assistant Conservation Director with Portland, Oregon, about the need to protect, not eradicate, our urban canopy. And I want to remind you that now is a good time to become a member of KBOO during the second week of KBOO's Fresh Off the Vine Fall Membership Drive. At KBOO, we are sowing the seeds of success, and you can help our radio community thrive during this drive. Join now and help us meet our $55,000 fall membership drive goal by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or you can mail a check to KBOO FM, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. And thanks for supporting community-powered radio. As you were talking about, you know, leaving spaces for trees, I was reminded of this restaurant I used to like to go to in Bend many years ago. I'm not sure if it's still there. I think it was called the Pine Tree Lodge or something. Mm-hmm. And there was this great deck you could eat outside, and there was this gigantic ponderosa pine coming up through the deck. When they built that restaurant, they built it around the tree. And I'm wondering if that maybe could be a model for the way we build our multifamily dwellings in Portland.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it is becoming in certain spaces a priority for, like, integrating trees into the design of housing, whether it's through courtyards, whether it's through other open space that is in adjacency to certain projects. And we feel like there are some entities like Portland Metro, who has been pushing forward on their affordable housing expansion that was funded through a couple bond measures in years past, is starting to do that and incorporating that into their design. And that's on the larger landscape. There are also a ton of great small developers who are doing so as well. And I think we just have to continue to lift up those projects, both for the community to see, the community to benefit from, but also for other developers and investors to see how much of an asset it can be into development.
Well, one of the monsters that came up in Sellwood in the last few years is this black building that's on the corner of Lambert and 13th. And it's just a big box, and it has this siding on the south-facing wall with no windows and this really ugly mural. But it was built with a courtyard, which I found very interesting. But they didn't plant anything in the courtyard. Now there's this giant Sasquatch that's for foot traffic. It's their little icon. And they have it right outside. And it's kind of, I guess, it takes the space that the 24-hour Church of Elvis used to hold, I think, in Portland. But I look, every time I walk by there, I think, what a lost opportunity. Why isn't there anything planted here? And I again wonder about the mindset and the cheapness and greed of the developer. I also understand the building is falling apart already, and it's only about 2 years old. So there's so many issues about the lack of oversight, I think, on the part of the city about what goes up, how it's built, and how to get that green stuff back in there again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It's sort of grounded in policy and sort of bringing trees into the very beginning of the development equation, which has not been the case for a long time in Portland, where because of our city structure and competing interests from different bureaus and different city council members, the other infrastructure bureaus, whether that's PBOT, Portland Bureau of Transportation, or the Water Bureau, or the Housing Bureau, they have always won out in sort of the argument of where trees can be allowed. And this is borne out in a lot of projects like that one you just mentioned. And it is also one of the reasons why I'm pretty excited about the shift of our city government that is coming in that.
Meaning what? What is the shift?
The shift. So we are shifting in a lot of ways to a more representative city council across four districts and 12 members, which will bring in more perspectives that cannot be as easily captured by business and industrial interests and corporate interests. So that is one. So we'll have more champions. And number two, and I think this is the more important piece for me, is thinking about our current and past system has really pitted priorities against each other, whether that's bureaus themselves, or more importantly, like the political ambitions of the commissioners who are in charge of those. With the shift to a city administrator, there's the real opportunity for there to be a singular vision that incorporates all of these really important priorities into the initial equation, and trees have a great opportunity of flourishing in that space.
I just had this image of having a march on City Hall of all the trees, yeah. And having all these trees sitting in council chambers holding up signs.
Yeah.
But I guess we could dress up as trees and do it. Maybe we should. I don't know. I feel that there's, I think about how Portland prided itself mm-hmm. on its tree canopy for so many years. And it's the way, it's a cynicism in a way that it feels like developers have gotten, I mean, developers never liked the tree code, mm-hmm. never wanted any tree codes. They're certainly in the forefront of stopping or encouraging and causing there to be these exemptions, like the industrial exemption for trees. But it makes me think about what we need to do to really stand up and to get a louder voice than they have.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think the geographic representation of council, of our future council, is, I think, a really important aspect of this, is because our previous councils have mostly represented the central east side or downtown Portland, both in where those council members have lived, but also the interests that have supported them. With our new geographic representation of four representatives from, three representatives from the four different districts, we'll be able to lift up the specific tree concerns from those communities, like Outer East Portland, which has seen a great decrease in the tree canopy over the last 7 years, and who can help inform those community members, can help inform policies to protect those geographic spaces.
Now, I'm looking at the notes that you gave me, and you were talking, this is about some grounds for optimism. Mm-hmm. And you have a thing, prioritizing tree integration as an essential infrastructure in ROW.
Yeah.
So what is ROW?
So the ROW, the right of way.
Oh,
and so,
okay.
And so that's intersecting with a little bit of what I talked about with the priorities of PBOT or the Water Bureau. And understanding that trees need to be considered by the city as a capital asset that they plan for and manage in perpetuity, because it is a public resource of cleaning air, reducing temperatures, cleaning water, creating more safer pedestrian walkways. And so with a sort of holistic initiative, the city can really focus in that space and shift the burden that is currently on private landowners to maintain street trees, which is really a backwards model, and from my perspective. And we have the opportunity to potentially shift that in the future, that we can plant trees and reduce the burden on those property owners or residents to maintain them, and the city should be creating a holistic program to do so.
One of the things that's frustrating as a homeowner with trees, I mean, you have to go through all this bureaucracy to even mm-hmm. get your tree planted, and there's only certain trees, which I understand all that.
Mm-hmm.
Then if you have a tree that's not working out, it's almost impossible to take it down.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's also not enough guidance in helping homeowners to plant. But my concern is if the city takes it over and PBOT has their funding slashed by, like, I don't know, 50%, it's pretty mm-hmm. gargantuan, the cuts that they're proposing, who's going to pay for this?
Yeah, yeah. So there has been long-term efforts to try to find a new funding source for to allow that shift.
Let's just sort of talk about why PBOT's funding, when I was reading about how it's based, it seems awfully regressive. So how are they funded right now? What's wrong with that?
Ooh, I'm not very knowledgeable on this, but I know it's mostly a gas tax.
Gas tax is parking meters.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, I don't even know if parking tickets are included. But and so they're complaining, well, people are driving more car fuel efficient or EVs now, and mm-hmm. so they don't have as much, they're not spending as much money on gas, and people aren't driving downtown so much, so they're not. So all the things we want people to do is actually a detriment to PBOT, which means, like, shouldn't they change their model of funding?
Yeah, and I agree they should, and I would lean into my sort of allies in the transportation space to lift up their solutions to that. But ultimately, we need to find a citywide funding source that isn't coming from or conflicting with other PBOT initiatives, but rather it's a general fund initiative that really prioritizes the long-term health of our urban tree canopy in both where we are installing trees and how we're caring for them.
Well, another thing that's very frustrating, the city has made some really scary, frustrating decisions about cutting funding for mm-hmm. certain projects. And two of them that pop up for me in the last year is defunding the Regional Arts and Culture Council, which I think there's going to be a fight around that, finally, and also defunding Friends of Trees.
Mm-hmm.
And I see kind of a connection between the two. Maybe it's because we're in this very seed-oriented pledge drive right
yeah.
now, thinking about vines and all that stuff,
yeah.
fruit of the vine. But it does seem like those two things are so integrated.
Yeah.
I want to talk a bit more about what happened to Friends of Trees, and then yeah. I guess there's a happy ending to that we'll talk about.
Yeah, yeah. So this is going to tack back to the agency dysfunction, where over... maybe not so recently, but over the last 5 years, there has been this internal conflict between the Parks Bureau, which includes Urban Forestry, and the Bureau of Environmental Services around who is going to be the leader of the sort of the tree planting efforts in the city. And that that conflict was political in a lot of ways, and it led to Friends of Trees sort of getting caught in the middle. Friends of Trees had been leading a significant community-wide tree planting program that engaged the community. And
for years, too.
For years, and was really successful in doing education, but as importantly, or more importantly, planting trees. That fell to the wayside during that conflict. There has now been a shift.
What do you mean by that fell to the wayside?
Their funding.
They got cut.
Yeah, they got cut for reasons connected to that. And yeah, over time, other community groups and Friends of Trees have been pushing for sort of the reinstatement of a community tree planting program. And there's some exciting efforts upfront in that space, both from external funding sources through the Inflation Reduction Act. Friends of Trees and a coalition of about 12 groups was recently awarded $12 million to do tree planting in Outer East Portland and in Eugene and Springfield and a couple other communities. But a significant portion of that's going to be coming to East Portland, which is awesome. There are also, last week, the City of Portland's Portland Clean Energy Fund Climate Investment Plan was passed, which is such a breath of good news, both for trees, but also climate resiliency as a whole for our community and climate justice. That allocated $40 million for tree planting in East Portland, which is really sort of forcing a model of collaboration between nonprofits and the city, and to sort of serve as a way to reform the way that we've done tree care work.
So that brings together housing and trees.
Yes. Yes.
Well, that is exciting, finally.
Mm-hmm.
And you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Michael Meskel, Assistant Conservation Director with Portland, Oregon, with Portland Audubon, about the need to protect, not eradicate, our urban canopy. And I want to remind you that this is a good time to become a member of KBOO during the second week of KBOO's Fresh Off the Vine Fall Membership Drive. KBOO receives 80% of our funding from our listeners, but only 10% of listeners are members. So help increase our member-listener ratio and meet our $55,000 Fall Membership Drive goal by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321, or you can mail a check to KBOO FM, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. And thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Well, in the last bit here, I want to talk about a few more challenges and then get maybe on to some more good news. Oh, we run out of the good news, I guess. So I guess I keep going back to the tree cutting that ODOT did. And I think there feels like there's a parallel between what ODOT was doing 3 years ago along the Sandingham Highway after the big fires there, where they mm-hmm. just clear cut, particularly around Brighton Bush, and what they're doing on Powell Boulevard, because Powell is actually a federal highway, but I guess ODOT is the status extension of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had this sense that ODOT is really just basically a clear-cutting company. But there, I mean, this seems like this, what's evil about ODOT? But I just feel like, what have they been doing, and is there any way to rein them in? Because there was like actually kind of a scandal about a lot of things that were going wrong.
Yeah, ODOT is on the other end of so many of our fights between the broader conservation sort of community in Oregon and Portland Audubon itself. And it really starts at the lack of leadership, both within ODOT and within the state government, to really push them to do better. We've continued to sort of allow them to be a very siloed and really obstructive agency that has not incorporated other community priorities and goals, whether that's community safety. They've shifted so much of their future funding towards large freeway expansion, which instead of meeting the need of the community to really increase community safety on their urban highways and in other corridors. It's also their just lack of consideration of green infrastructure within their designs and within their form of transportation infrastructure. And the governor, who is ultimately in charge of empowering the director to do the work at ODOT, could have a stronger mandate towards the protection of the environment, or a consideration of other community goals and livability needs within their investments. And there just hasn't been a leadership in that space.
Well, it seemed after a lot of stories came out about the, well, leveling between incompetence and outright corruption, the way that ODOT went about clear-cutting huge swaths of burned and unburned. They cut trees that were perfectly healthy. Mm-hmm. And it feels like, well, they're really just another timber company. And is that true, do you think? And if that's true, how does that get called out and corrected?
Yeah, it's a trend in that space, but also a trend in some of the freeway expansion projects, that they are driven by sort of their partners and the companies that they contract with to do a lot of the work. And so it is, and that those are moneyed interests that have impact on politics in a lot of different ways. And so that bears out in sort of the end product of a lot of these projects, whether it's the Rose Corridor freeway expansion, which was going to benefit a lot of planners and a lot of freeway industrial complex groups.
And not the neighbors.
And really not increasing safety, which was their primary charge. So it's borne out in so many different projects, and it's a continued effort. There's a lot of great leadership within the state legislature to reform ODOT, being led by Rep Pham of East Portland and others. And yeah, we're hopeful that the state, really from the top, Governor Kotek, can instill more consideration and prioritization in natural resource protection in all of their decisions.
I wonder how we can get Governor Kotek to listen to this show. I mean, because we've been talking about her a lot in the last few weeks. Mm-hmm. There's so many areas where she's really disappointing the environmental and conservation communities that really helped get her elected. Mm-hmm. I find it interesting. I was reading somewhere that the Oregon League of Conservation Voters raised a lot of money for her, and they're now one of her sharpest critics.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, are you hearing anything through the grapevine that maybe she might, or somebody underneath her is starting to listen?
I would say yes, a little bit. And again, this is grounded in my optimism, but post last legislative session, where we had a major battle over HB 3414, which really, in its most basic form.
Remind people what that was.
Yeah, House Bill 3414, which was the governor's housing initiative, which was grounded in pitting housing versus environment in a lot of ways. And it was very controversial. it ultimately died because of a lot of different reasons, but mostly the government walkout.
But yeah, one vote, actually. One vote. So she didn't get all those Republicans, otherwise it would have.
Yeah.
And it was basically going to roll back Oregon's legendary land use laws.
Yeah.
And really undermine urban growth boundaries and stuff that we think is sacrosanct here. So
yeah, and tree protections. And so, yeah, a lot of environmental groups pushed hard against that. And post-session, we have continued to sort of help shift the reframing of that effort. And so we've been having regular meetings with the governor's staff, and we are hopeful that it's going to lead towards a shift in the direction. And we feel there's an opportunity for the governor to lead on increasing housing affordability and climate resilience at the same time through a whole host of policy concepts that I think the environmental community could support, in addition to the broader community. And so those efforts are continuing weekly at this point, in hopes that we can inform this next session.
Well, and that's coming up soon. They're going to be having a short session starting.
Yeah, early 2024.
Yeah.
But a lot of the headwork that goes into that has started months ago.
Well, one last thing. You were talking about the shift in the Portland government. It's just going to be coming in a year. Yeah, well, actually, yeah, in a year. We're going to vote on it.
In November of next year.
Yeah, I mean, it's happening. The transition is happening right now, but it's actually going to go into effect in January 2025. What can people, listeners and people who aren't listening, do to assure that this new city government actually works for us? And again, how do we find all these ways to come together and find our commonality instead of being pitted against each other?
Yeah. So I think the first is engaging in the campaigns that I've already started for the new commissioners, or prospective commissioners. And so it's ensuring that those representatives or potential representatives hold in the environment and climate resiliency and whole healthy communities as a key component of their platform. That is the first step. There's also opportunities from now until then to advocate on specific decisions that the city is considering with the future structure. And so keeping an eye out for Portland Audubon will be weighing in on that, and our allies, whether at Willamette Riverkeeper or 350 PDX or others, will be pushing for specific ways that the city can start to make changes now.
I also know Sarah Taylor, who's with the Brady River Campaign and what's called the Emerging Coalition, and they're having, I think, weekly meetings to develop platforms that they will basically test potential candidates on to see if this is like going to be the suggested platforms. Are you also working on stuff like that?
Yeah, there's a couple different separate conversations that are going on to try to help inform that.
So in a nutshell, what would be in that platform?
Oh, man. So it's prioritizing climate resilience in all decisions. And so I think, yeah, one of those key things is shifting the way we think about trees. And so it really goes back to what we've been talking about and integrating it into all infrastructure decisions that we can make.
Yeah, I have a feeling it's also going to involve getting rid of the CEI hub.
Yeah.
That's a small problem we have.
Yeah, and evolving the economic opportunities analysis and pushing the city to further prioritize park expansion and a whole slew of other things.
Well, actually, there's one thing we didn't have time to talk about, and we should come back and do it another time. It's Forest Park, which is one of the things you talked about at the Rumble on the River, because actually there's a logging proposal that PGE is proposing. I don't think we have time to really get into that, but I think that we have to realize, too, that Forest Park, which is so sacrosanct, is also not totally protected.
Yeah. And it's one of the places where we're continuing to grow our urban tree canopy. And it's at risk by activities at the CEI hub, at Zenith, and this potential PGE expansion.
Well, Mike, it's great to talk to you. I'm glad we finally got you on Locus Focus, and I hope you come back really again soon.
Yeah, well, it's been great chatting with you.
We've been talking with Micah Meskel, Assistant Conservation Director with Portland Audubon Society, and you've been listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KPFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible as we climb out of this pandemic. And you can help us meet our $55,000 goal while we are in the midst of our fresh-off-the-vine fall pledge drive by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member, or becoming a sustaining member at that. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Ray Bodwell. Thanks very much, Ray. And next week we'll talk with Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper about the latest horrors at Hanford. We'll go out with The Dream Tree by Buffy St. Marie. Thanks for listening and stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.